Thousands gather in two Iranian cities to bid farewell to several victims of the recent terrorist attack in Shiraz. South Korea is reeling from a Halloween stampede that has killed more than 150 people and injured dozens more in Seoul. Good to have you with us. Now let's begin a special coverage regarding Lebanon. President Michel Aoun has left the presidential palace, and that a day before his term officially ends, in the midst of a stalemate over who will succeed him. Aoun delivered a farewell speech to a large crowd of his supporters who were gathering at the Baabda Palace east of Beirut. He talked about a recent agreement with Israel to demarcate Lebanon's maritime borders. He said the deal secured the nation's access to its natural resources, adding that the future revenues should be used to repair the Lebanese economy. Michel Aoun took office in 2016. Parliament has failed to agree on his successor in the course of four recent voting sessions. Lebanon has also been without a prime minister for more than a month. A presidential vacuum could deepen the political crisis in Lebanon that's already struggling with one of the worst economic meltdowns in the world. At least one Israeli settler has been killed and four others injured in a shooting attack in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. According to Israeli media, a Palestinian was among the four wounded. They claimed that the operation was performed by a Palestinian attacker who was subsequently shot dead. The Israeli army says it's conducting a sweep of the area for additional suspects. The latest operation comes as the occupied territories have seen a steep rise in shooting operations by Palestinians in recent weeks. The shooting also comes just days before Israel is to hold its fifth general elections in less than 4 years. Palestinian resistance movements, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, held the Al-Khalil operation. Hazem Qasem, a Hamas spokesman, said that the operation proves that the resistance in the West Bank is able to surprise the occupation forces at any place. He added that the resistance bullets are a practical response to the Zionist regime's settlement expansion in the West Bank. Iranians continue to mourn the victims of a recent terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. Well, earlier in the city of Shiraz, crowds of people gathered in a big procession to bid farewell to six of the victims. A similar event was held in the nearby Yasuj, the hometown of two other victims. Saturday, 2,000 mourners took part in a funeral in the northeastern city of Mashhad. On Wednesday, a gunman went on a rampage in a shrine in Shiraz, killing 13 worshippers, including women and children. More than two dozen others were also wounded. The assailant was injured by security forces and later died of his wounds in the hospital. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. Iran officials have pledged to bring those responsible to justice. Islamic scholar Mohammad Nasser Birria tells us about the significance of the huge funeral ceremonies amidst the riots in Iran.
Whoever looks at this huge amount of people, number of people who come to the processions and the funerals of the martyrs. From the first day that this act started, it shows that the real voice of nation in Iran are these crowds that they come to celebrate their victims, the martyrs. And this is a kind of vote for the Islamic Republic of Iran as well, and the government and the system. So the aim that the managers of these acts they followed to divide the nation of Iran into two parts and start crashes between them, it is failed. These are pictures that shows the failure of the managers of this movement, although they have planned from before, and we can see the hands of the managers of these movements, how they coordinated everything.
The South Korean president has declared a period of national mourning after a Halloween crush in the capital Seoul left at least 151 people dead. Yoon Suk-yeol says that the incident is a tragedy and disaster in the heart of Seoul that should have never happened. 19 foreigners are among the fatalities. They include nationals from Iran, China, and Norway. The toll is expected to rise as the scores of people were injured, some of them critically. The stampede took place while South Koreans were marking their first Halloween in 3 years after the government lifted COVID restrictions. Hundreds of revelers packed into an already crowded alley. People at the top of the sloped alley fell over, resulting in the rush. Most of the dead are women in their 20s. Okay, it's an important day in Lebanon. Just minutes ago, we had the Lebanese President Michel Aoun leaving the presidential palace and addressing his supporters who had gathered there outside the presidential palace. Okay, now we have no president. Four sessions have been held, no consensus on who will succeed outgoing President Michel Aoun. No prime minister either. It's been more than a month. So to get some insight, I'll be joined by a couple of guests. Our correspondent, Maryam Saleh, is joining me from the outside of the presidential palace. And Sandas Al-Assad is a journalist and human rights advocate. She's in Beirut and is joining us in this special coverage of Lebanon. Okay, first let's begin with Maryam. Tell us about President Aoun's speech to his supporters minutes ago.
Yes, it was a very significant speech, of course. He did mention that he is coming out of the presidential palace to come back to the people, and he said that you have always been with me, you have always supported me, and I will always be with you. And now we leave a phase behind, and he stressed that this was the phase of presidency where there should have been a lot of work that was not done, but that was the result of several circumstances, and he spoke about them, and he spoke about the fact that we do have a corrupt central bank, we do have a corrupt judicial system, and many people that were corrupt politicians that were supposed to be taken to court, that were supposed to be held accountable, were not even taken to court, and their files were not, and their cases were not studied by the judges, and he wondered in the speech he asked, is it because they are partners in crime with those politicians that those judges have not taken into court? So that was a very important portion of his speech. But he also said that the second phase after I leave the presidential palace will be a phase of resistance. It will be a phase of struggle, and we will continue this political struggle as we have in the past to try and liberate the country from all of this corruption. We also stress that the fact that we do have a demarcation of our maritime borders that allows the country to have hopes up when it comes to being to extracting gas and importing gas, and even having a sovereign fund that will be very significant for the upcoming generations. Part of it would be used for development, for reforms in the country, but there should be another portion that is for the upcoming generations, that we are not allowed to use up all of these resources, but we need to keep a lot of those funds for the upcoming generations that are looking forward to it. We also stress that this country cannot be continued to be ruled as it is right now. It is ruled by a clock that has been in power, a deep state that has been in power for more than 30 years, and they have caused all of this corruption. So therefore, we need to remove corruption from its roots, and we need to make more reforms, and that should be done through the parliament and through the struggle that continues for the Free Patriotic Movement as a political faction.
Okay. Now let me ask Sundas, given the plethora of the issues and the problems that Lebanon is grappling with. You know, there is also this vacuum at the presidential palace, no prime minister, no government for now. And this is while there are complaints by both officials and the people. They're complaining about corruption to the core, an unjust judicial system, and all that. So the million-dollar question is, what's the way out of this crisis?
The way out of this crisis is the unity of all the Lebanese together and their work in order to stop the foreign intervention in the Lebanese affairs. You know that what's going on in Lebanon is a systemic war led by the West, West powers, and in addition to the role of the vicious role of the Persian Gulf regimes, that they are intervening in Lebanon's affair. President Michel Aoun has been able, I believe that he's the president who has been able to save Lebanon from various hazardous crises, especially the these efforts to drive Lebanon into sedition. The president has been able to stress the role of the resistance in saving Lebanon, and the role of the importance of the Lebanese being united all together, the army, the resistance, the people, in order to face this rampant corruption in all the institutions in Lebanon that have been happening for decades because of the role of the warlords, especially those who politicians who are engaged with the Western powers, with the U.S. embassy and other Western powers. The Lebanese now, of course, will be facing a critical period, because, you know, we have government, we have no president. But I believe if the Lebanese unite all together, they will be able to elect a strong president, just like General Michel Aoun, who can unite all the Lebanese, because we are coming into a new era, an era of natural resources. This era need one stance, a new united stance, in order to save Lebanon from the other vicious schemes that are planned for Lebanon.
So we got to call this the end of this special coverage in Lebanon. Mariam Salah, our correspondent, joined us, and also sent us Al Asad, journalist and human rights advocate in Beirut. Now, there's a major disconnect in the United States between polls that show the average person's desire for diplomacy and the foreign policy choice of Washington. Candidates who are brave enough to oppose the war hawks are rarely allowed to make it into Congress, but voters are increasingly nominating politicians who insist on more peace. Rami Mazahari has more from Chicago.
In the United States this week, the small progressive branch of the Democratic Party was internationally embarrassed by its immediate withdrawal of a letter to President Joe Biden, which had urged vigorous diplomatic efforts to finally end the unrest in Ukraine. The letter was initially interpreted as the first sign of top-level friction within the Democratic Party over Ukraine, but within 24 hours, what became clear is that war hawks appear to have an iron grip over Congress. For a very small number of congressional election candidates, the U-turn showed exactly why Washington needs more politicians who are truly pro-peace.
Both parties have become more and more dedicated to increasing so-called defense budgets and unwilling to stop the executive branch from committing aggression and sending our troops all over the world. So right now, and for several decades, there is no peace party in America.
This month, a top poll on foreign policy showed that 65% of Americans want direct negotiations with so-called adversaries. 79% wants Washington to pursue diplomacy with Iran, and 80% wants more congressional oversight in the executive branch's ability to unilaterally declare wars. On November 8th, Americans go to the ballot box, and it's clear that an overwhelming majority of voters want representatives who will work towards peace and diplomacy. Why so few top-level candidates are willing to implement the people's will is a question that goes to the heart of American liberal democracy. Despite the opposition of the Democratic Party machine, his own Democratic governor, and even the Bernie Sanders-affiliated Democratic Socialists of America, the people of Kentucky's 6th District for the House of Representatives elected Mr. Young their Democratic Party nominee. His platform is centered around peace, advocates for abolishing the CIA and AFRICOM, and for the ending of all economic sanctions on all countries and individuals.
Sanctions, number one, violate the UN Charter. The United States has totally ignored that and goes around piling up hundreds of sanctions on Russia, China, Venezuela, Iran, any number of countries and individuals. All of them are illegal.
The electoral success of Mr. Young so far, despite stances which are so opposed by the Washington Beltway, may show that the war hawks in the Democratic Party could soon be on their way out. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
And with that, we come to the end of this broadcast from Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. The faith of some Muslims is such that in order to keep it safe, they should never open a newspaper, they should never read a book, they should never open their eyes, they should never speak to anyone, they should never leave their home, they should never go outside. Such faith cannot last. The faith that is needed is a faith chosen based on awareness. This is a faith that will endure even in the most difficult and dire of circumstances, barring someone who is compelled whilst his heart is at rest in faith. The Quran, Surah 16, verse 106, which was revealed about the Prophet's companion, Ammar Yasir. The Quran says that if you are being tortured, and in order that the enemy leave you alone, you tell them what they want to hear. Your faith is not a faith that can be diverted from its proper direction by persecution. The faith of Khabbab ibn Arat, when they pointed red-hot irons at his throat, is no joke. When they brought those hot irons close to his body and touched them against his skin, his faith was so deep and so strong that even this burning iron couldn't make him surrender it. This faith is based on understanding, based on comprehension, based on thought, based on correct calculations. When we have this faith, it is not necessary to put this faith under a cover or lock it away to keep it safe from the trials and travails of this world, because nothing can harm it in the first place. It is only these unthinking kinds of faith that some people have with which we need to concern ourselves. Unless this happens, or unless that happens, or unless something else happens.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If we want faith to stand firm, if we want faith not to vanish, and if we want faith to be based on understanding, then we must give knowledge to those people whom we want to be believers. We should not feel threatened by them learning. We should not deprive them of the enjoyment of gaining knowledge. Instead, we must make sure that the right knowledge is available for their hearts and minds, so that on the basis of this knowledge, they can nurture a true and strong belief, so that they will have a concrete foundation for their faith, so that their faith won't vanish when someone takes a shot at it. Islam says that faith must come from understanding. It is precisely this kind of faith that these verses at the end of Surah Ali Imran are describing. Indeed, in the creation of the heavens and the earth and the alternation of night and day, there are signs. The Quran, Surah 3, verse 190.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tehran has once again rejected baseless accusations about Iranian-made drones being used in the Ukraine war. The Islamic Republic's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, has clearly stated that Tehran would not remain indifferent if it is proven that Iranian drones are being used in the war in Ukraine against people. The top Iranian diplomat had previously stated that Tehran and Moscow have defensive cooperation, saying it's not Iran's policy to provide Russia with weapons and drones to be used in Ukraine. Tehran has time and again clearly stated its opposition to war and any escalation of conflict, urging self-restraint on both sides. Iranian officials say the allegations leveled against the country stem from an ongoing Western campaign to pressure the Islamic Republic. Russian officials have echoed similar remarks.
Everything that is now being done on the Iranian track is subordinated to one goal, pressure on this country. And Washington is mobilizing NATO and EU countries for this in support of its position.
Also, the US, EU, and UK have moved to impose sanctions on Iran over the baseless accusations, supporting the notion that the West only wants to put more pressure on Iran. Meanwhile, Britain, France, and Germany have called on the UN to investigate the allegation. But Iran's ambassador to the UN has described the possible probe as illegal within the framework of Resolution 2231. In a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antony Guterres, Amir Saidi Ravani argued that the UN arms embargo on Iran mentioned in the resolution has expired in 2020, saying this means no Iranian sale or transfer of weapons or related materials to other countries is ever since subject to the resolution. The Iranian diplomat also urged the international body not to act based on the anti-Iran allegations by Western countries. Meanwhile, Russia had described the claims by the Western states as conspiracy theories, warning the UN against conducting a probe into such allegations.
No arms transfers in violation of Resolution 2231 have been ever conducted by Iran, and no drones were supplied by Iran to Russia for the use in the conflict in Ukraine.
Moscow has warned that it would reassess its cooperation with the world body if it carries out an investigation into the origins of the drones. Tehran has dismissed accusations by some Western countries and their media outlets that it provided weapons, including drones, to Russia for deployment against Ukraine. Iran's foreign ministry has called the allegations unfounded and made on the basis of misinformation and ill-intentioned presumptions. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July, with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleging that Washington had received information indicating that the Islamic Republic was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred drones, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline for use in the war in Ukraine. However, the Pentagon said it could not confirm the transfer of any Iranian weaponry to Russia. Since the very beginning, Iran rejected the claims, with the country's foreign ministry stating Tehran's preparedness to hold dialogue with Ukraine towards nullification of the allegations. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has even proposed a joint meeting between Iranian and Ukrainian military personnel and experts to review battlefield evidence of Iranian drones used by Russia in Ukraine. Despite that, Kyiv and its allies repeated the baseless American narrative without providing any evidence. The US, EU, and UK imposed sanctions against the country. So, if Kyiv and the West are so sure, then why are they reluctant to provide detailed evidence that supports their claims? Plus, while Iran has managed to advance its defensive capabilities despite US sanctions, is Washington using Ukraine as a false pretext to bring the Europeans along in a bid to impose an arms embargo against Iran to hamper the country's progress in the defense sector?
Iran has witnessed a deadly terrorist attack. The carnage happened at a holy shrine in the south-central city of Shiraz in Fars province. It left over a dozen people dead, including women and children. Over two dozen people were also injured in the attack. The bloodbath happened at the Shah Cheragh Shrine, which is one of the popular pilgrimage sites in Iran. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. The gunman shot his way into the shrine through one of the entrances. He then headed to the main compound, where he opened fire at pilgrims and staff. Eyewitnesses have told reporters that loud screams were heard in the women's section of the shrine at prayer time, when suddenly an armed man was spotted with a Kalashnikov firing indiscriminately in the compound of the shrine. Officials say the perpetrator is a non-Iranian national who has been arrested. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a statement on the incident, saying that strong action must be taken to identify and tackle the root causes of such heinous crimes. The leader said that all people and entities in the country are responsible in the face of seditious acts by the enemy and their traitorous or ignorant stooges. He advised everyone to stay united against those undermining the people's security and disrespecting their sanctities. Iran says the attack is part of a larger plot to destabilize the country. Foreign Minister Amir Abdollahian says that Tehran has reliable information that shows that terrorists and foreign meddlers have created a multi-layered scheme to make the country insecure. He says this latest attack has unraveled the sinister intentions of those promoting terror and violence in Iran. Earlier, President Ebrahim Raisi expressed his condolences to the families of the pilgrims who were killed or injured in the attack.
These riots paved the way for terrorist attacks. They came to Shah Cheragh Mausoleum and sprayed with bullets innocent people who were worshipping God. The ground for such terrorist attacks was prepared by riots.
The carnage in Iran has sparked a wave of condemnation. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly censored the attack and called for bringing the perpetrators to justice. Syrian Foreign Ministry has called the mass shooting a cowardly act, while blaming the U.S. for using terror attacks as a tool to coerce nations into submission. Russia and China have also condemned the carnage. And Pakistan's Foreign Office spokesperson and the Speaker of the National Assembly have condemned the attack, saying the people of Pakistan share the grief of the Iranian nation. Sayyid Ammar al-Hakim, the head of Iraq's National Wisdom Coalition, also decried the attack. Iranian officials say the terrorist attack has revealed the actual extent of the enemy's cruelty. It comes against the backdrop of the latest foreign-backed riots, which erupted after a young woman, Mahsa Amini, died in the hospital 3 days after she collapsed in police custody. Iran has denounced the silence of human rights organizations on the terrorist crime in Shiraz. It says the terrorists based in the U.S. and Europe enjoy unwavering backing there, and Western countries refuse to publicly condemn terrorist incidents inside of Iran.
After 20 years of American deployment in Africa, the Pentagon has admitted that the area is getting worse. The Pentagon says the security environment has deteriorated and that violence has expanded in intensity and geographic reach. A report from the Pentagon's Africa Center for Strategic Studies has shown that militant attacks increased by 300% in Africa over the past decade. Violent events linked to militant groups have doubled since 2019. More than 6,200 violent events were attributed to terrorist groups in 2022, a 21% increase from the previous year. Almost 15,000 deaths were linked to the increase in terrorist-related activity. The West Sahel region and Somalia were the militancy hotspots where nearly 95% of the attacks had been carried out since 2019. Extremist groups affiliated with Daesh and Al-Qaeda militants, such as Al-Shabaab, are mainly responsible for the attacks. In this regard, the Pentagon's African Command, or AFRICOM, whose area of responsibility covers all of Africa except Egypt, describes the duties of the force as promoting regional security, stability, and prosperity, while assisting to strengthen the security forces of allied nations. But it also admits AFRICOM will work to advance U.S. national interests on the continent. Both Somalia and the Sahel are actively hosting U.S. troops, and the U.S. now has some 30 military bases scattered across Africa. Former U.S. President Donald Trump had ordered the military to pull out all its troops from Africa. However, the incumbent ordered the U.S. military to maintain a permanent presence in Africa. Last year, U.S. President Joe Biden authorized the deployment of hundreds of American troops to reestablish a persistent U.S. military presence. The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. Also, Washington does not have a good track record, even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Somalia is a perfect example of systematic American military failures across the continent. After 2 decades of deployments, drone strikes, and commander raids to fight Al-Shabaab terrorists in the country, the militant group has proven resilient and is still able to carry out attacks in the country as well as neighboring states. History has shown that the U.S. has brought instability and conflict to any region it has established a military foothold. Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya have all been subject to U.S. interventions and are experiencing chaos as a result. In recent years, there has been growing recognition of the militarization of U.S. foreign policy in Africa, especially following the establishment of the Africa Command in 2007. Despite its years-long military presence in Africa, the U.S. has not only failed to combat extremists and terrorists, but has also been involved in coups and the overthrow of several governments. Since 2008, U.S.-trained African military officers have attempted at least 9 coups in 5 Western African countries. According to a report, 8 such coups, which took place in Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Mauritania in different years, were successful. The failed coup was in Gambia in 2014. Confirmation is reported from the U.S. Africa Command that several African military leaders who staged coups in their countries participated in AFRICOM's flintlock exercises. Since 2015, 5 coups have been carried out by military leaders who had previously participated in Special Operations Command Africa flintlock exercises. The U.S. Department of Defense claims that these exercises, which were first conducted in Africa in 2005, are intended to strengthen the capacity of African countries to fight terrorism. But are they? Despite their claims, Americans have only been harbingers of more coups and more instability in Africa.
China seems to be going through a decisive change towards a one-man ruling system after several decades of power shifting. President Xi also has total control over the Politburo that he introduced among his closest allies. His power even extends to the military, as he also holds the title of Chairman of the Central Military Commission. In his most recent address to the CCP, President Xi pledged to pursue a very communist idea. He pledged to redistribute wealth to reduce inequality, as well as full employment. He also added promotion of gender equality, expansion of social security and healthcare, protecting the environment, and fighting the cancer of corruption as other items on his agenda. Despite the controversies that mainstream media tried to bring Xi into, China's current and future leader has been able to put the nation on a fast track to dethroning the U.S. as the world's number one superpower. But the U.S. isn't the only country that isn't enjoying the shift of power from west to the east. Josep Borrell, the representative of the European Union, whose recent mildly racist slash elitist comments stirred emotions.
Yes, Europe is a garden. We have built a garden, everything. The rest of the world, and you know very well, Federica, is not exactly a garden. The rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, is a jungle. And the jungle could invade the garden. And the gardeners should take care of it.
Has admitted to the role that China and Russia have played in his garden's prosperity. He said, "I think that the Chinese workers with their low salaries have done much better and much more to contain inflation than all the central banks together." He also said, "Our prosperity was based on China and Russia, energy and market. Clearly today, we have to find new ways for energy from inside the European Union, as much as we can, because we should not change one dependency for another." This is not the first time that Ursula von der Leyen makes inflammatory or accusatory comments about China or Russia. She does still recognize the crucial role that China plays in European economy, though. In the follow-up of the EU-China summit that took place in late June, she said that the EU-China relationship is simultaneously, quote, "one of the most strategically important and one of the most challenging." Regardless of what the EU or the US or the mainstream media says about Xi Jinping, or the numerous criticisms they throw his way, China is not fazed or threatened. China's economic recovery from numerous challenges, including COVID, came much earlier than many big global economies. And so the best market for China's goods has now become China itself. As Borrell said, the EU is reliant on Chinese goods and services, and not the other way around. This is the reason why the EU, despite warning China not to trade with Russia amid EU sanctions, hasn't been able to take any decisive action against the Asian superpower. The US has also tried to undermine China through meddling in Taiwan's affairs, In fact, U.S. President Joe Biden has made his most explicit statement so far on the issue by outright stating that U.S. forces would defend Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. He was even asked to clarify if he meant whether American men and women, unlike in Ukraine, would defend the island, to which he replied, yes. Despite all the attempts made by U.S. or the EU to undermine China, as Borrell stated, the EU can certainly look for domesticizing production and decreasing its reliance on China, but as it stands, the idea seems more like a distant dream than anything resembling an actual short-term applicable plan to get Europe out of the crisis it's in.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have an expert from the Islamic House of Qom, Hojatul Islam, Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Karimi. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
This is the second episode on how to control your sexual desires or lust. In the previous discussion, Hojatul Islam Karimi gave us an elaboration on the definition of the concept of shahwa and what are some of the ways recommended by Islam. Okay, Sheikh, let's get to some other practical guidelines in order to control our lust.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We shared some points in this regard, and today, inshallah, I will refer to some more, hopefully, instructions in this regard. One of the very important points, especially for people who are single, they are not married, I mean, young generation, the teens, is to avoid overeating and also disordered eating. So, for sure, the foods that we eat and the drinks that we consume, they have a very important role in provoking the sexual desires. Because when you eat too much, when you're overeating, then it will provoke what we call it the sex glands. So according to the Islamic instructions, overeating and gluttony is absolutely disliked, and people are encouraged to avoid overeating. And also disordered eating, we need to avoid that too.
Yes.
So both of them, overeating and disordered eating, they have a kind of role in increasing the sexual desires. Not only that, People who may not be able to get married, they are also encouraged to be selective in terms of food and drinks, because nowadays it is scientifically proved that some foods and drinks, they may, provoke these sexual desires. Yes. So,
for example, like liquors, wines.
And not only that, I'm talking about halal food too. When it comes to halal food and
oily
drinks,
food, for example.
Exactly.
Yes. Fast foods.
Yeah. So for those, especially if we are talking about single people who need to be away from sexual desires, and they are highly encouraged to be away from such foods and drinks which may provoke these sexual desires. And that is why, as you rightly mentioned in the previous session, according to the religion of Islam, for those people who cannot afford marriage, sometimes they are encouraged to fast too, because when you're hungry, then you may be more able to control your sexual desires. So the first one that I share today is to avoid overeating and disordered eating, and also to avoid the foods and drink which may provoke these sexual desires. There are some spiritual solutions and ways, so for sure, I mean, we are talking about some spiritual connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We may not understand directly how they help us control the sexual desires, but for sure they have great effects, like reciting the Quran, like saying the prayer, I mean, taking part in congregational prayer, Salat al-Jama'ah. And at the end of the day, we need to do tawassul to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam. So sometimes we may do all these solutions, but at the end of the day, we may rely on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and resort to the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam to help us. The next point is to avoid improper conditions and situations, meaning that, and it is mentioned in the narrations too, that if you're going to have a connection with a non-mahram, for example, try not to be with him or her in a private place.
Yes.
If that happens, the third person present would be the Satan. So my point is that we shouldn't fool ourselves. When, we are alone with a non-mahram, be it male or female, doesn't make any difference. So this condition, these situations, in and of itself, has a role in us not to be able to control our sexual desires. So in the long term or in the mid-term, such connections, such relations with non-mahram would, help Satan to deceive us. So we need to be away from such relations, from such connections, and from such, conditions. So it is mentioned in the narration, as I mentioned, that you need to be with non-mahram. If there is a need, there must be other people too. You shouldn't be alone with him or her in a place, in a room, for example. When it comes to the time for sleep, as I mentioned in the previous session, we need to be tired enough to go to sleep.
Yes.
And also, there should be a fixed time for our sleep, which unfortunately nowadays is not happening for maybe the majority of the people. They may sleep every day, every night, a time different from the previous night. So the fixed time for sleep is another important point. For those who are able, I know it's very difficult nowadays, but for sure one of the best ways to control our sexual desires is to get married. And for those people who are wealthy and they can help the youth, according to the narrations, one of the best ways for charity is to help poor young people to get married. And maybe only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows how great is the reward for helping the single people to get married. The other interesting point, we talked about controlling our eyes, controlling our ears, like not listening to haram music. The same is true about controlling our voice. And this is mentioned in a very interesting verse in chapter Ahzab, verse 32. So when it comes to non-mahram, again, we should take care of our voice and our tone. Allah, let me share the verse, recite the verse. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم, فَلَا تَخْضَعْنَا بِالْقَوْلِ, addressing the women, Then do not be soft in your speech. فَيَطْمَعَ الَّذِي فِي قَلْبِهِ مَرَضٍ lest he in whose heart is a disease yearn. So for sure it's not, I mean, haram for non-mahram men and women to talk to each other. But it might be forbidden for any of them to, change the tone in a way that may provoke the other.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So according to this verse, فَلَا تَخْدَعْنَا بِالْقَوْلِ, do not be soft in your speech. So, I think our dear listeners understand what I mean. There are some people who may try to deceive the other person, who might be, a non-mahram, through their voice, through using a soft tone and soft speech. So again, I repeat myself that we shouldn't fool ourselves. If we want to have a life with controlling the sexual desires, yes, we need to control our speech too. Again, in the long term, it would be, or even in the short term, it would be effective. Social media nowadays play a significant role in, preventing the people from controlling their desires. And that is why when it comes to cell phone and other social media, people should be careful, especially the parents, regarding their children. Let me share one interesting narration in this regard. Abu Basir says that, according to this narration, I was teaching the Quran to a lady.
Yes.
And once I made some jokes with her. And then I went to Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, and he told me about what I told that lady, that joke. Abu Basir says that I felt very ashamed before Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Then Imam told me, do not go to that lady anymore and do not teach her anymore. You see how the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt were very careful about this situation. What is taught is the Noble Book of Quran. But because of the fact that once Abu Basir made some jokes with her, and the Imam might have felt that they may continue to do that and it may have some negative consequences, Imam Baqir alayhi salam asked Abu Basir not to teach her the Quran anymore. This is showing the significance of controlling the type of relation that we have with non-mahram. The next point is to control what we smell. Control of olfactory stimuli. So this is also very important for non-mahram men and women. For sure, it is scientifically proved that there are some smells that, some perfumes that may provoke the people. So especially for women, they are highly encouraged not to use them for non-mahram, only for especially their husbands, they are encouraged to do that. But let me share one narration in this regard from Jesus alayhi salam. أَيَّمَ امْرَأَةٍ اسْتَعْتَرَتْ وَخَرَجَتْ لِيُوجَدَ رِيحُهَا فَهِيَ زَانِيَةٌ وَكُلُّ عَيْنٍ زَانِيَةٌ. We have zina in our literature is translated into adultery. According to some narrations, there are a kind of zina or adultery for each part of the body. So the zina of the eye is to look at non-mahram with an evil intention. And according to this narration, if a woman uses perfumes and then she goes out so that the non-mahram men would smell the perfume, then it is as if she has committed adultery. So it's not referring to that, adultery that we are familiar with. It is metaphorically used for such a lady who has committed this sin. وَكُلُّ عَيْنٍ زَانِيَةٌ, and those people who look at her, they are also committing adultery, meaning the adultery of the eyes. And the next one is to control I mean, because especially nowadays, when it comes to the relations between men and women, some people object Islam for preventing men and women who are non-mahram from shaking hands. Again, I repeat myself, we shouldn't fool ourselves. For sure, if you're away from any kind of physical touch with non-mahram, be it in terms of shaking hand or any other relations, we are more able to control our sexual desires. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, لا يحل للرجل أن يصافح المرأة إلا امرأة يحرم عليه أن يتزوجها. It is not permitted for a man to shake hand with a lady who is not mahram to him. There are many narrations in this regard. So to put all these narrations together, if we are really trying to control our sexual desires, first of all, we need to have the will.
Yes.
And for people suffering from weak will, they need to, try to strengthen their will. And if you're really trying to do that, these are some of the solutions and instructions mentioned by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the infallible Imams and the Prophet, peace be upon them. And but the point is that whether we are serious in that or not. If you're serious, if you're acting upon this point, then for sure Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would help us too. This is mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran that الَّذِينَ جَاهَدُوا فِينَّا لَنَهْدِيَنَّهُمْ سُبُلَنَا. Those people who try to get close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would help them too. So as long as we have not done anything, we cannot expect Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us. But if we show our seriousness by doing these instructions, then for sure Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would make this job easier than us, easier for us too, and we would be, inshallah, able to get rid of this problem, inshallah.
Inshallah. Thank you very much. And we know that most of the corruptions and the delinquencies that are taking place in today's world, one of the main roots and the reasons is the power of lust. And this is not what only the Muslims believe. This is what the Western scholars, in the secular governments also believe, that there has to be and there have to be some ways to control our sexual desire and sexual drives in the country, especially among the teenage and among the kids nowadays in the world. Thank you, Ahmad Sheikh. I hope that our dear listeners benefited from the Islamic teachings regarding how to control our lust or sexual desires. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
Palestinian land.
deal of the century, the Trump so-called peace plan, which the Israelis and the United States of America claim will bring peace to the Middle East. But the Palestinians